This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and just a word of caution for those with younger listeners, this segment may include graphic language of a sexual nature. The court-martial of Fort Bragg Army General Jeffrey Sinclair began yesterday. He stands accused of having an affair with a junior officer, sexually assaulting her twice, and requesting nude photos of other female soldiers. General Sinclair may be the highest-ranking military officer ever to appear before a jury. Craig Whitlock has been covering the case of Army General Sinclair, and he's a reporter for The Washington Post who covers the United States military and the Pentagon. Craig, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Tell us how this case against General Sinclair got started.
Well, it's been 2 years in the making. It's been 2 years since Army officials in Afghanistan were suddenly confronted by a female captain who was serving there, who went right to the commander, a two-star general there, to say that she had been having an affair with a brigadier general, General Sinclair, for some years, but that he had assaulted her on a couple of occasions, he had forced her to have oral sex, and had threatened to kill her and her family. And this set off a very quick, intensive investigation, but it's taken 2 years to actually bring it to a court-martial.
Tell us what's happened in those 2 years.
Well, there's been a very in-depth investigation into General Sinclair. It's very unusual to have a criminal investigation of a military general. Just to put it in some perspective, this is only the third court-martial of a U.S. Army general in at least 60 years. And this is the only one that I can find record of where a crime of violence has been charged. So it's extremely unusual. And as you have pointed out, it comes at a time when the U.S. military is confronting a lot of public concerns on Capitol Hill and across the country about how it handles allegations of sexual assault. So to have a general in the Army who is serving in Afghanistan to be suspected of this, set forth, unfolded a very lengthy and in-depth investigation.
And just to kind of clarify some of the issues involved here, it would already have been a breach of military code of conduct and the grounds for a court-martial to have had an affair with a subordinate officer. That would be one crime in and of itself within the military, a breach of military conduct, right?
Well, that's right. It's against the Uniform Code of Military Justice to have an affair. Adultery is a crime in the military. Now, that said, this isn't the first time that officers have been accused of having affairs, and what often will happen is rather than go to a court-martial, they're disciplined administratively. It isn't done out in public. Maybe they have to resign, they're fined, things like that. But, this case beyond adultery, it's a very serious charge that General Sinclair forced this female captain on a couple of occasions to engage in oral sex, and that's a whole other level of seriousness. So that's not something the Army's been willing to plea bargain away or deal with outside of a trial, a full-blown court-martial.
And last week, the original prosecutor stepped down from this case. What do we know about that?
Well, it's a very shocking development. I know that sounds like a cliche, but it is. Here's the prosecutor who, for almost 2 years, had been leading this case into General Sinclair, appearing in court, telling a judge that, he suspected of very serious crimes. And all of a sudden, last month, he calls up the defense lawyers to say that he's has grave doubts about at least one of the charges, the most serious one, about sexual assault, that he doesn't he has concerns about the reliability of the female captain, the chief witness, and that he had urged the Army to plea bargain or at least drop the most serious case. That's a pretty striking development. And then yesterday we, in court at Fort Bragg, Army officials came forth to say that the prosecutor had been under extreme amount of stress. They were worried that he had been drinking, that he was suicidal, and that they brought him in for a mental health evaluation, and that's why he was removed from the case. So, quite a bit of drama on top of an already, very dramatic case.
A dramatic in and of itself, as you say, after 2 years of working on this case, to say that he was considering dismissing it. What is even stranger about this is that while the prosecutor was on the verge of, or at least recommending dismissal, it was the military commanders who wanted to move forward. That's a bit of the reverse of what we thought we would hear in this case.
Well, that's right. And it's important for people to remember that the military justice system is different from civilian courts. In the military system, the prosecutors don't have the final say on whether a case goes to trial or whether someone is charged. That's up to a commander, a senior commander. The prosecutors, you know, will try the case in court, will oversee an investigation, but, you know, they don't make that decision, unlike a district attorney or prosecutors in civilian courts. So in this case, you had the prosecutor apparently recommending that these serious charges be dropped, but the commander is saying, no, we're going to go forth with it. As you point out, Frank, you know, the complaints we've heard a lot in public from advocacy groups, from people in the military, from lawmakers in Congress, is that they're concerned that the commanders are the ones who haven't taken these kind of complaints seriously, and they've been urging that these cases be turned over to prosecutors to decide. So this is really a flip side of that, where the prosecutor was saying, I think the evidence is too shaky. We need to pull back. But the commander is saying, no, we're going ahead with it.
Why did the commanders decide to go ahead?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's something that General Sinclair's lawyers alleged, that politics were playing a role, that the Army doesn't want to be seen right now, especially, as being soft on sexual assault, so that even if the evidence is weak, they want to go ahead and bring this case to trial. At least that's the defense version. And a judge said, you know, after they made this case yesterday, the judge disagreed and said, no, there's not enough evidence to show that politics played a role. You know, the commanders can make an independent decision on this. And if they decided they wanted to go forward, you know, the witness, the woman who made the complaint is still sticking by it, so we're gonna bring it to trial.
This trial is really at the crux of many of the issues surrounding debate over the Military Justice Improvement Act. Tell us about that.
Well, in Congress, in the Senate, Senator Gillibrand, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, has come up with a bill where she wants to make some of the biggest changes to military law in some decades, and that would strip commanders of the authority to decide whether to bring charges in serious cases like sexual assault. Not you know, every case, but, you know, serious crimes, crimes of violence, things like that. This is a very controversial proposal in Washington. The military brass hates it. They say that commanders need to retain that authority to watch over people in their units. You know, they're the ones who are responsible for everyone in their chain of command, and stripping this authority away is essentially saying that they can't be trusted to look out for the welfare and discipline of their troops. At the same time, so far it seems that a majority of senators have signed on to this bill as co-sponsors or said they support it, saying that, you know, the military's been talking about taking sexual assault more seriously for years and years and years, and it's still a big problem and something dramatic needs to change. We'll see what happens. In the Senate these days, a simple majority isn't all that it takes to get a bill passed, as you know, and the outcome of this is very much uncertain.
Well, let me clarify this for me. Would this strip the commander of the authority ever to bring charges, or simply remove from the commander the possibility and the authority to stop charges from going forward?
Well, that's a good question. What it would do is it would turn that over to prosecutors, that authority to bring charges and bring it forward. The commanders really would be removed from that process.
But they could always activate a process if they
Yeah, they would have some role, but it would take them out of it.
Yeah.
In major crimes, not all situations. If, you know, somebody doesn't show up to work, somebody goes AWOL, something like that, the commanders still retain that authority. But on serious crimes, that authority would really be given over to prosecutors.
So this confluence, this the fact that the trial begins today and debate is underway or about to begin in the Senate, is a remarkable confluence of events. What impact is the debate having on the trial?
Well, I think there's impact both ways, and I think it's certainly a legitimate question. I think people in the Army know, at the Army, most senior levels of the Army leadership, they know that if they had dropped these charges against General Sinclair or plea bargain them away while the Senate's getting ready to debate this, that it would be seen by at least some critics, fairly or not, that they don't take these cases seriously, that they would be looking to protect one of their own, a general. So I think they recognize there is a political aspect to this. Now, of course, they will say they're handling the case by the merits of the evidence and so forth, and, you know, that may be, but there's no question that politics is a, you know, is the elephant in the room on this. At the same time, in Congress and in the Senate, senators hold up these kind of cases very quickly. We've written about a couple of other cases in the Air Force where generals in the Air Force overturned convictions of sexual assault for reasons that were kind of hard to follow, and this caused a real firestorm in Congress and ended the career of two generals just because they had that power to intervene. They did, and overturned jury verdicts, and that cost them their careers.
Craig, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Happy to do it, Frank.
Craig Whitlock is a reporter for The Washington Post. He covers United States military and the Pentagon. On the State of Things coming up next, we will continue our conversation on sexual assault in the military. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachon. Once again, a word of caution for those with young listeners. This segment may include graphic language of a sexual nature. Before the break, we talked about recent developments in the trial of Army General Jeffrey Sinclair, but this case is just the latest instance of sexual misconduct accusations in the military. The Pentagon released a survey that showed about 26,000 active duty members said they had experienced unwanted sexual contact in 2012. And that report shined a light on what many already knew was a serious and growing problem in the military. Patricia Harris has had direct experience with sexual misconduct in the military. Commander Harris is the leader of the North Carolina Department of the American Legion. She is a combat veteran whose Army unit was among the first to enter Iraq in the first Gulf War. She is also a victim of rape and sexual assault while in the service. Patricia Harris, welcome back to our program. It's good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Tell us about, you've had a number of experiences with sexual assault in the military going back to when you were 19 years old, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, just first coming into the military, and one of the big things that that I had talked about before is that it's always those that violate that system of trust. When we have our first initial contact, we're talking to, you know, people that are going to tell us that you don't have to worry about people mistreating you or talking ugly to you, cussing you out. Well, all of that stuff, you know, went out of the window, you know, because there's a culture, a military culture that we're going to have to learn how to, you know, deal with and acclimate ourselves to. But the other part about it, you know, when I think most veterans can look back and recall, you know, their early days of basic training, and that platoon sergeant, that initial drill sergeant, those people you always remember. And the first ones, you know, that have a lot to do with your military training, you know, you always remember those people.
Well, tell us about your experience, because you were so proud to enter the military. Your father had done it, and it was a service you wanted to honor his memory and his service. He was still active in encouraging you to do that. And then your first experience that, in a sense, took the stars from your eyes in that moment.
Yes, it did. I'm 19 years old. I initially started with the reserves, and then I decided I wanted to go active duty. So to do that, to exactly 1 year, you have to be retrained, and now you're regular Army, and you're going to go wherever, you know, the Army wants you to go, and you're going to have to take on a job that they want you to do. And so in my particular case, 19 years old, went back to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, to wait for a unit of others that was going to go to the Signal Corps at Fort Gordon, Georgia, because this was going to be my new job. And I had to wait for them, you know, to graduate from basic. So I was kind of, you know, over there as a layover. And during this time, the same mess hall that I used to use, utilize when I was in BASIC myself and in AIT myself, well, it was a certain staff sergeant that was there. And I was on my way to the airport to, you know, leaving Columbia Airport to come back home to get my car. And then I was going to drive back. That was my intention. Well, we had a red eye flight, and then they decided they didn't have enough people. So they canceled that flight. And so the next flight was going to leave at 5 o'clock in the morning. So I had to make a phone call. And I called a friend of mine that I was currently dating at the time. And he also worked in the mess hall, in that same mess hall. And he wasn't there, so I left a message. And the guy that did the kidnapping was the same one that I saw during the time that I was, you know, in basic training during KP and all of that. Had no idea, you know, that this guy was this way. And it's just always that sinking feeling.
When you say did the kidnapping, he kidnapped you.
Yes, he did. I called, you know, to try to get me a ride back from the airport. And he took the message. And I guess he must have took the message and he set it down somewhere. But instead, he was the one that showed up at the airport, not my friend.
You didn't go back to the base.
No, I did go back to the base, but not the way that I thought I was going to go back to the base. I wind up, you know, with him in the car. And you always know, you just know that something is not quite right, you know, with this. And this guy took me to a place where he went and got some drugs. And then there was a big scuffle. And then I'm trying to figure out what in the world is going on with this guy. And it was two other co-workers with him that actually saw him with me and asked me when they saw me, what are you doing with this guy? Because your friend is looking for you. And that's when I knew I was in trouble. And the guy came out. I tell you, it was a big fight trying to get in and out of the car, you know, with him getting in. And I'm asking him a whole bunch of questions. And I don't remember how exactly I got on base or how I got back in the car. But I do know that there was a scuffle between him and I was knocked out. And then I remember being over his shoulder. And then I know I came to from that, and then I started fighting. But this guy was just
And you knew that you had been sexually assaulted.
I knew that whatever it was going to be ugly. And but by the time I got to his room, that's when all of the horror came. And I was strapped to a chair and tape over my mouth, and this guy did a lot of ugly sexual things, you know, in front of me.
Did you report him?
I wasn't until I had to let my dad know about what happened because he didn't like the idea about me trying to disguise it. And he took me back on post and made me confront that. And it was at that point that I had to do it then.
Did you feel that you had been? Why did you try to? Why did you at first not want to report this?
I was embarrassed, ashamed. I didn't want to have to answer the questions. What did you do to bring this on yourself? I didn't want the attention, you know, of the other drill sergeants and anybody else to know that that has happened. I didn't want to look at myself as being weak or that somehow someone could thought that I caused it. And I didn't want to disappoint my father.
This was not the last time you were assaulted. About what year was this? You were 19 years old, and this was...
This was 1980.
This is 1980, and it's not the last time that you were assaulted in the military.
No, right after we came back from Desert Storm, there was a closed encounter with most people in the military in the units. They're always very close to each other, and in this particular case, it was a sergeant that was in my platoon, and yes, he did... He raped me while we was out in the field on the field exercise. And that was one that I did not report that because my husband at the time was alive. If he'd known about that, then there would have been another problem.
Hmm. And you never reported that one?
No, I didn't.
Well, we are talking today about sexual abuse and sexual misconduct in the military, and there are efforts underway to address the problem of sexual misconduct. We invited the Department of Defense Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, or SAPRO. We also asked Fort Bragg Sexual Harassment Assault Response and Prevention Program. They both declined in light of the ongoing trial with General Jeffrey Sinclair. Lieutenant Colonel Kathy Wilkerson of SAPRO did give us the following statement, quote, "The leadership of the department has no higher priority than the safety and welfare of our men and women in uniform, and that includes ensuring that they are free from the scourge, including the threat of sexual harassment and sexual assault." Unquote. There are also advocacy groups trying to get tougher legislation to prevent sexual abuse. Greg Jacob is a policy director of Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. Welcome, Greg. Good to talk with you.
Good to be here, Frank.
So you heard Patricia's story, and I'm sure that you've heard many others. How significant an issue is this in the military?
Well, first, I just want to thank Commander Harris for telling her story today. It takes a lot of courage and it takes a lot of strength to come forward and to discuss the kinds of issues and the kinds of crimes that are going on in the military right now. This is a very prevalent problem within the military. The Sexual Assault Prevention Response Office, one of their roles is to collect data on this issue, and their last report showed that there were over 3,000 sexual assaults that were reported in the military last fiscal year. However, they also acknowledge that's about only 15% of the total number of assaults. They also do a survey where the 26,000 number comes from, which is unwanted sexual contact in the workplace. That includes rapes and sexual assault. So it's a very big problem in the military, and the military has continued to say over the past 25 to 30 years since Tailhook that they have this under control, that they're dealing with it, that it's a problem that can be solved through increased training and increased programming. And it's only been recently that they've actually taken a real hard look at the prosecutorial process and how that works within the UCMJ.
As a commanding officer yourself, you were told stories about sexual assault. How did you handle them?
Yeah, I was in a unit, actually. I was a Marine infantryman for 10 years. And as such, I didn't have women in my unit until I was the company commander at an integrated training company at Camp Geiger outside Camp Lejeune. And we had a student report one of my instructors conducting himself in an inappropriate manner that included sexual assaults. So I was told to do an investigation, which I did, and my recommendation was that the individual be taken to trial. The investigation went to the convening authority, who was the base commander at the time, and he decided that it shouldn't go to trial, even though there were 87 corroborating statements, but that the individual just wasn't suited for an integrated training environment. He was transferred to another unit, and all of the students that were involved in that case graduated and went out to their units with the full understanding that, you know, when something like this happens in the military, that nothing is really done about it.
Well, what's interesting to me is that you were asked to look into it. The commander of the base then makes the final decision. How much legal training did you or he have at all to make those judgments?
Well, that's one of the fundamental problems with the military system, is that it's a command-centric system. And like Craig mentioned in the previous segment, it's the commander that decides whether or not a case goes forward. And that commander is making that decision based on a lot of different things, not just the evidence, not just the testimony of witnesses, but also on the needs of the unit, the reputation and the value to the service that the accused possesses. And you're correct, commanders don't have a lot of legal training. I mean, I went to college as a journalism major, and I played drums in a punk rock band. So I had no legal training whatsoever until I stepped into my role as an officer and as a commander. And then I was basically just a well-intentioned officer with a big, thick book of rules and trying to do my best to make these decisions in consult with my first sergeant and with the legal officers.
We appear we have lost our connection with Greg Jacob, who is a member of SWAN, an advocacy group that is at the moment promoting the Military Justice Act. You were, as you heard Greg tell his stories about, particularly what happened in Camp Lejeune, you were shaking your head, Patricia Harris, as you heard that story. And it seems to me you had a knowing look in your eye.
Well, that's true. I thank him for everything that they're doing, too. SWAN is a very, very important asset, you know, in trying to make sure that this stay in the forefront. And I respect all the work that they do, and I commend him, you know, for stepping in and making sure that he look at it from his point of view as well, because it's just like I've said earlier, you know, all commanders are not the ones that want to put it on, shove it under the rug and act like it's not important. But it is amazing to me whenever there, you know, we have those issues of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct that are being reported and brought to the light. 87 complaints over a person. And then all of a sudden, we don't want to bring the embarrassment.
Right. I mean,
and
that,
then let's just transfer right. this person on. And you're transferring the problem. You're transferring a predator. You're transferring someone that commit a crime. And it's just totally unacceptable.
One of the men who abused you, once you reported what happened, it turned out that there were other complaints against him.
It was at least 8 other yeah. women. And he actually raped them.
So what do you think about then the Military Justice Act and taking authority away from commanders to prosecute these cases and to bring prosecution?
Well, I have to be truthful. I haven't really made a decision on how I really think about that, because I've been trying to look at that at every aspect. What if this situation lies into the hand of a woman commander? How would she react to that? Would she have the opportunity to actually push this forward and to strip that totally away, you know, and where she may go ahead and say, hey, we just need to put a stop to it. If it's been brought up, the charges are validated. You need to do something about it. It's just a no-brainer. It's just dumb to just keep, you know, shoving it and right. keep transferring the problem.
Well, Greg Jacob is back. He's a policy director at Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. Tell us why you are certainly advocating for the Military Justice Act. Tell us about your rationale for it. And you heard Commander Harris express some reservation about taking all authority away from commanders. Maybe you could also address that.
Right. Well, the bill doesn't take all the judicial authority away from commanders. What it does is it takes violent crimes of felony level offenses and sends them over to the military prosecutor for a decision to be made on whether a case goes to trial, which is how the civilian system currently operates. The problem, aside from what we were talking about before, about really the lack of qualification for commanders, and you know, that's not to say that commanders are bad people. I mean, the majority of them are well-intentioned. The majority of them want to do the right thing. But really, if being well-intentioned and wanting to do the right thing were enough, we wouldn't have to have law schools or bar exams or prosecutors that are able to get cases in court decide these kinds of problems. So the first one is just that it's really the wrong person making this decision. Commanders should be able to command, and lawyers should be able to lawyer, which is basically what the bill does. The second thing that the bill does is it alleviates a lot of the issues that are coming up in this General Sinclair trial with regard to undue command influence. You know, the idea that a commander moves a case forward for some reason outside of what is presented to him as the investigation, either through political pressure or because a previous higher-level commander has told him to do something. That's the kind of thing that doesn't happen when you have an independent judiciary. So it would alleviate a lot of those concerns around undue command influence. So really what it does is it provides more justice to victims and survivors like Commander Harris, and it also provides for increased and more robust due process protections for accused members of the armed forces like General Sinclair.
You've said that the military justice system itself is really what's on trial in the Sinclair case. Will we move beyond? Certainly sexual assault is something that deserves our undivided attention now, but are there bigger issues in the whole military justice system we should be looking at?
Well, that's what the bill does. I mean, the bill is not a sex crime specific bill for a reason. And, you know, the reason is that when you're talking about serious criminal matters in the military, they need to be treated like crimes. You know, up until 5 or 6 years ago, the military treated sexual misconduct like it was a relapse in professionalism, or that it could be solved through increased training, or the individuals in the military just don't understand what a sexual assault is, so let's have a class and teach them, and that's going to solve the problem. And clearly that hasn't solved the problem, because we have increased assaults year after year after year. So if the military is going to treat this issue like a crime, then it needs to have a system set up that will prosecute the cases like a crime. And it's really that faith in that criminal justice system that enables victims to come forward and make reports without fear of recrimination, without some of the examples that the Commander Harris was talking about in terms of being put on trial herself as a victim and these kinds of things. When you have a robust system that is fair, then that enables people to rely on it and trust in it, and that is what will bring them out of the woodwork and bring them forward and increase the number of prosecutions.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Greg Jacob is Policy Director for Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. Thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Commander Patricia Harris is the leader of the North Carolina Department of the American Legion. Commander Harris, always a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me here.
Stay tuned to the State of Things. There's more just ahead.